Good evening, everyone. I'm Neil Love from Research to Practice, and welcome to Implications of Recent Datasets for the Current and Future Management of Non-Small Cell Lung Cancer in Patients with EGFR Tumor Mutations. This is a follow-up to the World Lung Meeting, the World Conference on Lung Cancer of 2024, the ISLAC meeting that just concluded today in San Diego. So we're thrilled to have a great faculty today. Dr. Josh Sabari from the NYU Langone Health and Perlmutter Cancer Center in New York City, and Dr. Helena Yu of the Memorial Sloan Kettering Cancer Center, also in New York City. Today, we're here to talk about EGFR mutant lung cancer, particularly as it relates to what happened at the Lung Cancer Conference, the World Lung Cancer Conference, but also recent publications of interest, including what happened at ASCO. As we do in all of our programs, we will be talking about non-FDA-approved uses of agents and regimens. Check out the package inserts for more information. So basically, we asked both of the faculty to put together some slides summarizing some of the new developments in terms of clinical research, particularly as it relates to, obviously, EGFR mutant disease. But before we get started with that, hear some of your cases, I got to ask you about, which I guess is maybe the story, Josh, of the meeting. We saw a press release coming out about this bispecific PD-1 and VEGF agent. I call it ivonescimab, that was presented a phase 3 trial. We're going to talk about it on Thursday. Actually beat pembro, including in PD-1 greater than 50%. A solid move forward. I think it will be much discussed. Great discussion by John Haymock. We'll talk about that on Thursday. But I want to ask you two, starting with Helena, about this paper was presented. We're going to talk about mainly targeted therapy, but of course, an important issue with EGFR is the use of immunotherapy, which generally we haven't been doing, or may do it at the last opportunity. But Helena, at ASCO, we saw this paper, and then it was published in JAMA right after, looking at this bispecific that we'd heard about before. These were in patients with EGFR mutant disease, a study done in China, but interestingly using this, I would call immunotherapy, in these patients compared to chemotherapy alone. They saw a pretty significant benefit. And Helen, I don't know if this is exactly practice changing, you know, it's all Chinese and a lot of caveats to it, but I was just amazed that we saw some benefit in EGFR mutant from immunotherapy. We've had some hints with, you know, bevacizumab and EGFR mutant disease. Any thoughts about this? Maybe you can talk about what this is in your mind and where you think it might be heading.
I think it's interesting that the plain, when we just use PD-1 inhibitors in EGFR mutant lung cancer with chemo, we have seen no positive studies. The negative Keynote study with pembrolizumab, the negative Checkmate study with nivolumab, but the only studies that have had shown a glimmer of efficacy in this population have been when PD-1 inhibitors have combined with VEGF inhibitors, and that's with IMpower 150, with atezolizumab and bevacizumab, as you mentioned, Neil, or sintilimab with bevacizumab, and then this study. So, you know, I think they're really looks like, you know, something's there, I would say. You know, I think it is a crowded space where, you know, there's a lot of other novel agents like antibody drug conjugates. And so this is, while intriguing, you know, we also have chemo with amivantamab, or, you know, we have the HER3-DXd. There's different other options. And so I think we need more data, but it is interesting that these studies with VEGF have been the ones that have actually shown something in this population.
And we will get more into the management of relapse disease, usually after osimertinib. But Josh, you know, was so happy they picked John Haymock. He's my anti-angiogenesis go-to person. I think he worked with Dr. Folkman for a long time. They should have given him 10 more minutes to get into the biology. But any thoughts about this sort of interesting connection to VEGF with EGFR, Josh?
Yeah, so there's many studies, actually some led by Helena Yu here, about, you know, using VEGF inhibition in the EGFR mutant space. We know that there's definitely synergy there. There's actually an approval for a VEGF inhibitor with our earlier generation EGFR TKI. And we saw recently at MD Anderson, I'm sure under the guise of John Hamack, ramucirumab and osimertinib, a phase two study that looked impressive. I agree with Helena here, though, that this is ivonescimab plus chemo versus placebo plus chemo. So it's not really a VEGF PD-1, you know, versus placebo. So, you know, it's hard for me to really make heads or tails out of this 2-month benefit in PFS. I agree with Helena. There are a lot better options that are biomarker selected for this patient population.
So we'll see what happens with Ivo. It looks like not too much toxicity, a little bit of VEGF, proteinuria, hypertension, but not too much else. So I'm going to be real curious to see what happens with the PD-1 high non-EGFR patients. I mean, the data looks pretty good, but we'll see. All right, well, let's get into targeted therapy. Actually, we're going to start out with a case of a patient who went on the trial. But really think about it more from the point of view of the options we have now, and then Helena will get into the data. But for upfront treatment of metastatic disease, Josh, I guess the thing that jumps right out at you over here is this is a younger patient, 52 years old, otherwise well. Can you talk a little bit about what happened?
Yeah, she's a young woman, mother of three, active, works as a lawyer, came to her PCP with cough, got a chest x-ray and found to have a right upper lobe opacity. Interestingly, she was a sort of former collegiate smoker, which we can commonly see in this patient population. Here you can see her imaging. She unfortunately has a dominant right upper lobe mass. It's FDG avid on PET. And unfortunately, on her MRI brain screening image, you see a left sort of parietotemporal metastasis there. And again, not uncommon to see CNS metastasis in these young patients who are light or never smokers. So we did plasma next generation sequencing. We also confirmed on tissue next generation sequencing, but we identified here an EGFR L858R mutation. This is the second most common activating EGFR mutation that we identify in clinical practice. And important to note that on these plasma next generation sequencing assays, even a low variant allele frequency, here we see 0.3%, this is completely actionable. So we initiated first-line amivantamab and lazertinib actually as part of a clinical trial, but we had an in-depth discussion with this patient of what was available. And at that time, osimertinib was available as an option. And this patient wanted more. She wanted to be more aggressive. She had CNS metastasis, a large burden of disease, and she was young, and she wanted to be aggressive in her treatment paradigm. So despite having a grade 2 infusion-related reaction, flushing, some chest discomfort on the first day of the infusion, she actually tolerated the therapy quite well. She did develop some mild rash and acneiform rash, as well as some lower extremity edema. But here you can see her first restaging scans showing a very nice reduction in that right mass there. And, you know, quite an impressive response. She did have some issues with therapy over time, mostly due to rash, but we were able to mitigate and manage these in the clinical practice. So I want to just point out that, you know, these drugs have upfront toxicities, but also have long-term toxicities. And you know, this is from a manuscript. This is not my patient, but here you can see the acneiform rash on the sort of perioral, on the chest. You can also see paronychia, as well as some of those skin breaks that need to be managed appropriately and upfront. If not managed correctly, these can become chronic, grade 1, grade 2. Patients oftentimes will dose reduce or even come off of medications due to these types of side effects that are occurring over time.
So, Helena, we're, you know, later on we'll get into the issue of the first-line therapy. Josh is going to review a lot of the data, but obviously the other option that's out there is a chemo plus osimertinib. I'm just kind of curious. This is a younger patient. I think Josh is going to get into more detail in his talk about how he thinks it through. But just to sort of introduce the idea, can you talk about sort of how you think through first-line therapy, these three major options? And, you know, a lot of people talk about younger versus older, but then there's older people who are very proactive and there are younger people who aren't too proactive. But anyhow, maybe just a little bit of an intro about how you begin to think about this complicated decision, Helena.
It's definitely complicated. You know, I think of it as risk stratification. I think one, you have to think about patients' goals and what they're willing to tolerate and how aggressive that they want to be. But separate from the patient, I look at the disease. How much disease burden do they have? Do they have central nervous system metastases? What's their mutation? Is it L858R, which we know is more aggressive oftentimes than exon 19 deletion? Do they have co-mutations like TP53 or RB1 alterations? And I think, you know, that as a whole gives us a sense of, you know, aggressiveness of disease. And then we combine age, willingness to come in for intravenous treatment. And then that can help us, you know, what I'd say, risk stratify people and then come up with a risk appropriate treatment.
All right. Well, let's let Josh go into some of the data, including some of the things that were presented in San Diego. I think they may be even relevant to this patient, actually. But Josh, why don't you take it away?
Thanks, Neil. And, you know, I agree with Helena. This is a really exciting time for our patients. So I'll start with the data. These are the three prospective trials that we have. And if you haven't heard of the FLORA trial, you're living under a rock. This is the first study to show the improvement of a third generation EGFR TKI over first generation gefitinib and erlotinib. And what was quite impressive at that time was an 18.1 month median improvement in overall survival. If you remember, first gen TKI about 10.2 months. More recently, we saw the FLORA 2 with the addition of chemotherapy to osimertinib, and we'll go through that data in some detail. And then more recently, the MARIPOSA regimen, which looks at amivantamab and EGFR and MET bispecific in combination with lazertinib, a third-generation EGFR TKI. And what's really exciting is we're starting to see overall survival data emerge, and particularly we saw an update on the MARIPOSA trial survival data. So keep these numbers in your mind as we go through some of these slides here. You know, osimertinib in the FLORA trial, 38.6 months median overall survival. FLORA 2 has not yet been reached, but we've seen some data cuts over time, and I'll show them. And then MARIPOSA also not yet reached, but the control arms, interestingly, performing relatively similarly here for osimertinib across all three trials. So here's the FLORA data, and we talked about that historic 18.9 month median progression-free survival. But what I want to drill in on is if that you had an L858R mutation, your duration of response, your progression-free survival was more in that 14-month range. Exon 19 deletion patients, more in that 22-month range. So important to understand that there's a difference in response across different EGFR mutations. And here you can see the overall survival data, and this seems quite old by now, right? Already 4 years old. We have that 38.1 or 38.6 month median overall survival for osimertinib versus the comparator here, first generation EGFR TKI of 32 months. A lot of folks ask, why is that so high? You have to remember these patients can cross over to receive the better third generation EGFR inhibitor. Now, when you look at the progression-free survival with and without brain metastases, we know that patients with brain metastases far, far worse than patients without brain metastases. So the CNS is an active area of concern, and we'll talk about that in the FLORA 2 data as well as the MARIPOSA data in the frontline setting. So standard of care for many years, really since 2018, has been osimertinib in the frontline setting. So why combine therapies? Why add therapies for patients? Well, you know, it's interesting. If you think about combination strategies, we do this in many diseases. We combine two active therapies. There needs to be a clear improvement in the progression-free survival that's more than just the sum of them or sequencing of those two agents. We also know that combination studies demonstrate improved progression-free survival above that additive sequencing action. And we'll talk a little about FLORA 2 because commonly we were giving chemo in the second line. With FLORA 2, we just moved chemotherapy to osimertinib in the frontline setting. And then also remember, not all patients receive second-line therapy. And we saw that on the FLORA trial, 30% of patients dropped off. So it might allow patients to receive more aggressive sort of therapy up front. And I think combinations are important, but at what cost? What is the cost here? And really the cost is toxicity. So here we're looking at some of the FLORA 2 data, clearly increase in hematologic toxicities. Although we're pretty good at managing these in our clinical practice, there's also a financial cost to patients. You know, patients who are on combination strategies are generally having more toxicity issues, tolerability issues than single agent osimertinib. Here's the toxicity data for amivantamab and lazertinib. You know, we're dealing with more skin toxicity here in the long term. We're also dealing with increased rates of venous thromboembolism and the requirement for prophylaxis with anticoagulation. And up front with the infusion, the IV formulation of amivantamab, we're seeing an increased rate of the infusion-related reaction. So I think these are all important things to think about with our patients when we talk about combination strategies. So let's dive into the FLAURA2 trial. Remember, the FLAURA2 trial added chemotherapy to osimertinib versus osimertinib alone. And we see these two different curves here. The one on the left is the investigator assessment. The one on the right is by blinded independent central review. So the investigator assessment was actually the primary endpoint, 25.5-month median PFS for chemo and osimertinib versus 16.7 months for osimertinib alone. And for me, you know, that's an impressive improvement in osimertinib. And again, we talked about the cost. Here's an updated overall survival slide that we saw at the European lung cancer meeting most recently. Hazard ratio here of 0.75. The curves sort of come together, cross, and then dissipate again. We look forward to seeing an update survival in this setting in the near future. We know that progression-free survival for patients with intracranial metastases was far better with chemotherapy in addition to osimertinib than osimertinib alone. And important, you know, pemetrexed may have good CNS penetration in this patient population.
So before we go on, just to come back to Helena, just kind of curious in terms of some of the different strategies that Josh talked about. One thing that you're going to talk about, and I'm just kind of curious how you think it fits into this equation, is maybe a better TKI. So for the typical activating mutations, what's the likelihood that we can find something better? Definitely with the unusual mutations, that seems like there's a lot of opportunity there. But what do you think it would take to sort of, you know, beat osimertinib face to face, Helena, or is it too much data at this point?
I think that we have set a very high bar for ourselves for EGFR exon 19 and L858R. I mean, I don't see anything on the horizon that's going to beat that for the common sensitizing mutations. But exactly like you said, Neil, I think for these fourth gen TKIs are focused on the atypical sensitizing mutations and then the acquired EGFR alterations.
All right, let's talk a little bit about amivantamab, interesting bispecific.
Yeah, so amivantamab, an EGFR MET bispecific, you know, initially developed to sort of target acquired resistance. And, you know, the data was exciting early on in the phase one dose escalation and now has been moved into the frontline setting. We'll really focus this discussion on the Mariposa trial. But here you could see the mechanism is threefold. It can block ligand-induced activation in the cell membrane. It can also lead to receptor internalization and degradation. But I think most important, it has an immune activation, this antibody-dependent both cellular trogocytosis as well as an antibody-dependent cellular cytotoxicity. So, you know, we talk a lot about immunotherapy, but largely our immunotherapeutic options have not been an effective strategy in this population. And I think this is one of the first therapies that sort of moves us more towards hopefully having some immunotherapeutic benefit, potentially that durability that we have not seen in the EGFR mutant population historically. So here's the Mariposa trial. And as you remember, the Mariposa trial is a randomized controlled trial, international study of amivantamab and lazertinib, lazertinib being the third generation EGFR TKI versus osimertinib. There was a third arm for the contribution of components of lazertinib alone. So over 1,000 patients randomized 2-to-2-to-1, primary endpoint here being progression-free survival. And we saw this data presented at ESMO, now published in the New England Journal of Medicine, progression-free survival for amivantamab and lazertinib about 24 months versus 16.6 months for osimertinib alone. And I think that's really important. And, you know, a lot of people ask, well, how did lazertinib do? We saw some updates at this meeting on lazertinib. But interestingly, lazertinib and osimertinib were relatively equivalent, 16.6-month PFS versus 18.5 months. And remember, the lazertinib was not set to identify superiority here. It was just to understand the contribution of components. At what cost is there this benefit in PFS for patients? Well, we know there is definitely more skin toxicity related to EGFR inhibition. You know, things such as paronychia and rash, almost twofold the osimertinib. One interesting thing to note is diarrhea, less common with the amivantamab-lazertinib combination compared to osimertinib. We know that osimertinib may hit EGFR wild type a little more than amivantamab and lazertinib. There are also some MET-mediated toxicities, things such as hypoalbuminemia, peripheral edema, and then that infusion-related reaction that we've talked about, and we've been able to mitigate, and we'll talk about one of the interesting abstracts at this meeting. This was presented at ASCO, trying to look at some prognostic biomarkers. Again, these are prognostic, not predictive. Brain metastases, liver metastases, P53 co-alterations all seem to benefit or favor amivantamab and lazertinib over osimertinib alone. Here's the longer follow-up, first-line amivantamab and lazertinib. We just saw this data presented by Dr. Gadgil, and I think it was quite exciting to see that after about 31-month follow-up, median overall survival still not reached for amivantamab and lazertinib, for osimertinib coming in at 37.3 months, very similar to what we've seen in FLAURA2, as well as FLAURA, the initial trial. One thing I really want to focus in on is the intracranial progression-free survival, and this data was just presented, 25 months median for amivantamab and lazertinib, and remember, we monitored the CNS routinely on this study versus only 22.0 months for osimertinib single agent. So seems to be an improvement as well, not only in survival, but also intracranial progression-free survival. And here are some of the exploratory analyses we looked at from the control arms of lazertinib versus osimertinib, relatively similar activity for both of these agents. What I do think was interesting, again, is that osimertinib seemed to have a little bit more diarrhea, as well as a little bit more cardiac toxicity, but probably minimally sort of differential in my clinical practice. Two other important abstracts, we saw patient-relevant outcomes for MARIPOSA were not significantly decreased or inhibited by amivantamab and lazertinib versus osimertinib alone. Clearly, there is more skin toxicity, but was apparently well managed on the clinical trial. And then lastly, we saw an update on the SKIPPER trial, a very interesting sort of management study using prophylactic steroids for patients receiving amivantamab infusion on cycle 1, day 1. So a strategy here of improving the reaction, and hopefully into the future with subcutaneous formulation, we may see that mitigated even more. So, Sunil, I really want to open this up here and have a discussion a little bit on, you know, not every EGFR mutant patient is the same. And I want to sort of think about this paradigm here. And Helena, how do you differentiate these two patients in your mind?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we know that, you know, each person's cancer is different, but I think these are really good examples where you can't put your finger on it, but you can definitely, the sum of all of these things, if people are asymptomatic, if they have a low disease burden, if it's thoracic only, we have some follow-up scans to show that things are slow growing. We check a garden blood test and the ctDNA is negative. That seems different, right, in an older patient. And then, you know, both of us have had the young, you know, huge symptom burden, fast growing, diffuse metastases, kind of the genetics that tell us that something is more aggressive as well. You inherently want to treat these patients different. And absolutely, like this figure of yours shows, I think, you know, the idea, it makes sense to escalate the person on the right. And it absolutely makes sense for the person on the left, who probably will do well on osimertinib monotherapy for years, to stick with that. And I think we need to be granular about this and hopefully, you know, kind of have guidelines. But I ultimately suspect that this is how we're going to manage patients moving forward.
So one question I'm curious about, Josh, is, you know, we saw in myeloma with daratumumab, incredible change once it went from IV to sub-Q. And I know that's been reported now with amivantamab. Is that the direction we're heading? And what do we know about how that mitigates infusion reactions?
Yeah, so we saw data from PALOMA-3 presented at ASCO, and that subcutaneous formulation of amivantamab plus lazertinib to TKI versus the IV infusion of amivantamab plus the TKI. And, you know, with the IV formulation, we're seeing infusion reactions in that 65-70% range, with the subcutaneous formulation as low as 10%. So clearly an improvement in the reactions. What's important to note is in that study, we also saw a small benefit in overall survival with the subcutaneous formulation over the IV formulation. So I look forward to seeing more data generated in the frontline setting using the subcutaneous formulation. One important note is that the rash and the skin toxicity, though, did not appear to be different with the subcutaneous formulation over the IV infusion.
Anything you want to comment on, Helena, about the sub-Q? And also, when you use IV, any pearls about how you deal with the infusion reaction?
Yeah, I have some slides on the sub-Q study, the Paloma study, but I think it's going to be a game changer. I think sub-Q administration can at some point be at home. Patients don't have to come in. You know, it's going to be so much more convenient. I think that the studies that Janssen have done, I think that, you know, the steroids, they're really, I think, being proactive about figuring out ways to mitigate the infusion related reaction. I think the higher dose steroids beforehand, some of the other, pre-meds like hydroxyzine. So I haven't seen, you know, with all of those now kind of implemented in my practice, you know, the infusion reactions obviously occur, but, you know, they're occurring in I think, I don't know if Josh, you agree, but in less patients for sure.
Yeah, I agree. I think we're better at managing. We're better at identifying them. You know, early on, you know, this was probably the most concerning toxicity. It's not something that we worry about currently. And Neil, I'd be remiss if we didn't touch on EGFR exon 20. So with your permission, can we jump to the exon 20 space just
Absolutely.
For a minute or
yes.
two? So we talked about sure. L858R and exon 19, which are quite common mutations, common EGFR mutations, historically called activating mutations. Exon 20 insertion mutations are really rare, 1% to 2%. And I remember as a trainee in Dr. Yu's clinic, seeing an EGFR exon 20 patient and, you know, really not having many options for these patients. So here we're looking at the frontline study of the Papillon trial. This is taking amivantamab, which was approved already in the second line, and combining it with chemotherapy in the frontline setting versus chemotherapy alone. And we saw a dramatic benefit here in the progression-free survival, 11.4 months versus 6.7 months for ami chemo versus chemotherapy respectively. And we also saw a significant improvement in response rate here, 73% for ami chemo versus 47% for chemotherapy alone. And the overall survival here is still maturing, similar toxicities that we've talked about already. So it's really an exciting time for patients. And I think identifying what EGFR mutations patients have is critical, but also having the discussion with them on what is the best frontline regimen for them.
So did I hear you say you worked with Helena? Were you like her fellow or something?
So I know I look older, but Helena was my attending in fellowship. So that's my claim
wow.
to fame.
Wow. So how was he as a fellow, Helena?
He was great.
You know he was going to be a star?
I knew he was going to be a star, and all my patients loved him. So,
But I learned
you gotta
everything
go into
I
lung.
Know. Everything I know about lung comes from Dr. Yu.
Well, you know, all of our work is based on rounds because to me, that's the best way to learn. But anyhow, before we go on, Helen, anything you want to say about exon 20? Kind of seems like, you know, we're making some progress, but anything exciting on the horizon?
I would say that Papillon study that Josh just mentioned, that is practice changing. I think most of us now are giving chemo amivantamab first line. I would love to give a pill to these patients. And I think that's what many of us are kind of holding out hope for. I think that there are some on the horizon, zipalertinib, sunvozertinib. So hopefully we'll get some more approvals to just give us more options in that space.
All right, well, let's get on to some new agents and new developments in the field. But we're going to go back to a case, and Helena, this is a patient, actually, I guess you saw a little bit over a year ago, presented with stage 4 disease, went on osimertinib. What happened?
Yeah, so young woman, 58, she had distant extrathoracic metastases when I met her. She started on osimertinib therapy after some discussion of different options. And she did well for just over a year, so a little bit less than what we typically see with osimertinib monotherapy. And she had kind of significant progression. There was a liver metastasis and new bone mets. And so we did repeat biopsy just to look to see if there were any acquired alterations. We didn't find anything new, but just confirmed the EGFR L858R mutation. And so, you know, some were investigational, but some were not. We did have, you know, different treatment options for this patient. We discussed quite a few things. I think that the biggest thing are sort of the, you know, we talked about different clinical trials, but since we didn't find an acquired alteration, I think it really came down to, does she want to do chemotherapy by itself or chemotherapy with amivantamab? And Josh introduced us all to amivantamab, and we'll talk more about it kind of in the later space. But, you know, she was pretty committed to being as aggressive as possible. And so it was an easy choice to move ahead with carboplatin, pemetrexed, and amivantamab. And she did, you know, I think similar to Josh's case, you know, she did great. I think she had quite quickly a clinical response where her bone pain was better. With the chemotherapy amivantamab combination, you definitely see more neutropenia. And so we did have to hold, you know, a cycle, and then we gave Neulasta with subsequent cycles. But she's been on about, you know, 3 months and continues to do well.
Josh, can you talk a little bit about how you think through this clinical scenario? Also, I think this patient was on a study. I know you didn't put it in the write-up, but I want you to talk about it in a sec because it's super cool, I think. But Josh, how do you generally think through this situation of a patient who's responded to osimertinib now progressing?
Yeah, I mean, most patients are going to have robust responses to osimertinib, right? Response rate's about 80%. But unfortunately, all patients will develop, you know, resistance. And that's the case, too, for osimertinib and chemo or amivantamab and lazertinib. So, you know, unlike in the non-driver mutant population where we're seeing durable long-term cures in some patients, we really don't achieve that in this patient population, unfortunately. So, you know, I agree with Dr. Yu's workup here. I would generally reprofile the patient starting with a liquid biopsy, circulating tumor DNA to identify a resistance mechanism or mutation that could be actionable. If I didn't identify one, I would discuss doing a biopsy with the patient. Oftentimes, though, we don't find resistance mechanisms that are actionable, and we're left with chemo plus minus osimertinib or the Mariposa 2 trial, which Dr. Yu mentioned here, amivantamab and chemotherapy.
So you got to tell us about this trial the patient actually was on. Anytime I hear ctDNA, I always I'm curious. I love
it's the magic
this
words.
Trial sounds like very cool. So tell us about it.
Yeah. So, you know, one, you know, we talked about before kind of thinking about ways to risk stratify our patients. And one way that has really come out is, you know, looking at ctDNA clearance. So most people shed ctDNA, so circulating tumor DNA, before they start treatment, but the majority clear their ctDNA if you happen to check later. And so the kind of best validated time point is 3 weeks after you've started the targeted therapy. And they've shown this with immunotherapy and other treatments as well. But 3 weeks after you start osimertinib, only about 20% of people will have persistent ctDNA where you can continue to detect the cancer in the blood. And those people are at highest risk for a short time on osimertinib monotherapy. Their median PFS is only 10 months versus 20 plus months if you end up clearing. And so we have a clinical trial, basically Flora 2 for that high risk group, where if you have persistent ctDNA, then half the people continue on osimertinib with close surveillance, half the people will get chemotherapy added on. And that's part of this whole strategy of, you know, patient-directed care, where we're individualizing our recommendations on, for treatment based on, you know, a specific cancer versus giving a generic recommendation for everyone.
So, Josh, any comments about this kind of strategy? You know, well, we're going to be talking on a breast cancer program coming up. They have a trial where they put people on endocrine therapy for metastatic disease, and then if they develop a subclinical resistance mutation, they randomize between switching or not just by seeing the mutation. Could you envision a similar strategy in lung cancer? Maybe they clear their DNA and then it comes back and you treat versus not treat? You think we're going to be treating subclinical disease?
I was so excited when I heard about this study that I actually asked Helen if we could open it at our institution, and she graciously allowed us to open it. So we've enrolled a lot of patients. I think this is a phenomenal strategy because it allows us to escalate care when needed and potentially leave patients at, you know, a good therapy if they're benefiting from it. And, you know, I think this might be a new paradigm for how we develop novel combinations into the future. You know, using ctDNA clearance is actually a biomarker of aggressiveness of disease. So kudos to Dr. Yu for doing this trial, and we're excited to contribute, and we hope that it changes patient outcome.
So let's talk about some of the new developments in this field, Helen. I was just thinking this is around the 20th anniversary of the discovery of the VEGFR mutation. I remember that because we did I did an interview with Tom Lynch just about the time, almost when it was about to be published. I didn't even know about it at that time. And then all of a sudden it was here, and wow, it's been quite a story. So let's talk about what's going to be.
Yeah, 2020.
20 years since it was discovered. Now, wow, we're spending an hour. We can't even go through it all. But let's talk about some of the new things, Helena.
Absolutely. So, you know, this was alluded to, and my patient actually did this regimen, but this is the Mariposa 2 study. And so this came out over the last year, and you know, it included patients with L858R exon 19 deletion. So as we said, the common sensitizing mutations, they were only on TKI or targeted therapy as their previous therapy. And they were randomized into these three arms: to chemotherapy alone, chemotherapy with amivantamab, or the amivantamab lazertinib chemotherapy arm. And here are the data. So this also, you know, I think really substantial results where we did see a significant improvement in overall response rate with both the doublet and the triplet is sort of what we call it. You can see that the AMI chemo and the AMI laser chemo arms did actually perform quite similarly, but both superior to standard chemotherapy alone. And I think that this is the PFS data where we can see that there probably is an incremental improvement with chemo-AMI and chemo-AMI laser, but that, again, there was a big difference between AMI chemo and chemo alone. And intracranial progression-free survival, this is so key, and we keep bringing this up because more than 50% of patients with EGFR mutant lung cancers will ultimately have brain metastases. So starting with you know, drugs that are CNS penetrant and every line along the way, you know, we really need to be looking at intracranial response because it's so critical for these patients. But why I think amivantamab and chemotherapy arose as the appropriate option is toxicity. I think that it was pretty clear kind of as the study went on that the amivantamab lazertinib chemotherapy arm was challenging when it came to cytopenias. It really was hard to get through the required cycles of chemotherapy. And so I think, you know, the study results really honed in on amivantamab and chemotherapy as a practical, doable regimen that clearly improves on the standard of care, you know, beyond chemotherapy. And so I think that, you know, just to stop there and say that this is, I think, a practice-changing study, you know, in this space. I think people are, you know, if people have not gotten FLAURA2 and they have not gotten amivantamab and lazertinib in the first-line setting, using the chemotherapy with the amivantamab for the appropriate patient, you know, is a definite, you know, option that a lot of us are providing our patients. This is the PALOMA 3 study. So this is what Josh had alluded to. And I think this is a really important practical study that's going to make a big difference for our patients. And this is that study that looked at sub-Q amivantamab plus lazertinib versus intravenous amivantamab plus lazertinib. I think an important fact and, you know, is that these were later line patients. And so they had previously been treated with osimertinib and platinum-based chemotherapy, so later line therapy. And really the primary endpoint of the study was looking at PK and showing a pharmacokinetic equivalence between those two groups. And so I think it was sort of a extra bonus that we did see that there potentially was extra efficacy with the sub-Q arm. I think the slight edge in both overall response rate, duration of response, as well as overall survival with the sub-Q arm, I think is is a huge thing. And this is the progression-free survival. Again, a numerical but significant numerical improvement in progression-free survival. And I think what makes this so good for our patients is if amivantamab becomes subcutaneously administered and lazertinib is an oral therapy, this becomes something that, ultimately can be done with much less impact in terms of, patients coming to the hospital and requiring infusions. And here's the survival data. I think this is, again, compelling. A hazard ratio of 0.62 for survival is, quite marked, in the field of lung cancer. And so, I think this hopefully will be a real option for our patients moving forward. And safety, I think, of course, important. I think the big key here, as Josh mentioned, the point of the sub-Q administration really was to mitigate the infusion reactions, which absolutely 66% of patients with the intravenous amivantamab and 13% with the sub-Q amivantamab. And then just to mention again, some of the infusion-related issues like pyrexia, fever, dyspnea, nausea were mitigated with the subcutaneous, but the things like rash, and paronychia really were quite similar with the two. And then switching gears entirely, I think there is a lot of development in the later line space in EGFR mutant lung cancer. And so this is the HERTHENA-Lung01 study, which is one of the first antibody drug conjugates that have been looked at in this space with EGFR mutant lung cancer. And I'm sure in a lot of your programs, Neil, ADCs are all the rage in really all of cancer and including lung cancer. But this one was, because of HER3 expression being pretty widespread in EGFR mutant lung cancer, the development plan of this agent was really focused on EGFR mutant lung cancer. So HERTHENA-Lung01 is the phase 2 study where this agent, which is a HER3 antibody-directed antibody-drug conjugate, was looked at patients after EGFR TKI and after platinum-based chemotherapy. Patients with brain metastases were allowed on study, and you can see the waterfall plot of tumor shrinkage here on this slide. And then what I think is really important to note is, Josh had mentioned earlier that, we don't tend to find resistance mechanisms, after we biopsy folks after osimertinib. Only about 25% will have an acquired alteration. But, because of this heterogeneity in resistance after osimertinib, something like an ADC or chemotherapy really have appeal because you're addressing sort of all of the resistance clones and not focusing on a clone that's really only relevant for a subset of patients with lung cancer post-osimertinib. And then, as I mentioned before, intracranial efficacy really is key. And so when looking at patients on the HERTHENA-Lung01 study that had measurable brain metastases that were untreated and had not received prior radiation, the intracranial overall response rate was basically the same as the systemic response rate. And that's what you see with an active drug that has active CNS penetration, where if it works, it works everywhere. And I think the curves on the bottom just show that, the main place or, a site of progression with HER3-DXd really tended to be non, extracranial disease, systemic disease, even in patients with a history of brain metastases. In terms of progression-free survival, in the phase 2 registrational study, the median PFS was 5.5 months, median overall survival 11.9 months. Remember, this is a more heavily pretreated population. And then with ADCs, in terms of toxicity, we have to remember that these contain chemotherapy. So we see nausea, cytopenias, neutropenia, fatigue, alopecia as class effect for really all of the antibody drug conjugates. The ADCs with the deruxtecan backbone do have varying rates of pneumonitis. It was about 5% with patritumab deruxtecan, but it can be as high as 15% with trastuzumab deruxtecan. So that's something absolutely to watch out for. But definitely an active drug in this space.
A couple things before we go too much farther. First, picking up when you were talking about the Mariposa study and AMI chemo. Josh, I'm curious, in what situations in general when patients are progressing on osimertinib do you continue? I've heard people talk about doing that for brain mets. And if you do, what do you do if you're going to give them ami chemo?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, you know, if someone is benefiting from therapy and has oligoprogressive disease, and, you know, in 2024, that may not mean just one site. It may even mean a few sites. But if I could capture or incorporate all of the active areas of a disease, you know, rationally with radiation, I will generally do that and continue therapy with osimertinib alone, particularly if patients are doing well. If they have systemic progression, multiple sites, liver, bone, brain, you know, that's really where I think about changing the therapy to something like, you know, amivantamab and chemotherapy. Remember, this is not a, you know, sprint. This is a long marathon, and we want to try to squeeze as much time as we can out of each one of the therapeutics that we have. So commonly we'll use radiation in oligoprogressive disease.
Anything you want to add to that, Helena?
No, absolutely. And I think, you know, the one instance where I might want to keep the osimertinib going is a patient presented with, you know, a head full of brain metastases that have, you know, had a complete response to osimertinib, systemic progression. That would be a time where I think I would be more reticent to stop the osimertinib, and that would be a person that maybe I would add in chemotherapy, keep the osimertinib going.
So, Josh, these data on patritumab look pretty interesting. I could imagine that maybe it's going to become available. If it were available, how would you use it? Where would you fit it into the sequence?
Yeah, I think it's really exciting. I mean, it's not as biomarker strategy-wise as amivantamab and chemotherapy is, and it potentially has a bit more toxicity, as Dr. Yu had mentioned. I would reserve this really for the third-line setting, and again, we're still waiting to see the full approval, hopefully any day now. But, you know, this is a therapy that is an exciting one. Like Helena said, the ADCs are really rampantly moving into the EGFR mutant space. I think we need to better, you know, understand which therapies to use for which patients, and really biomarkers are lacking in this setting.
So also it brings up the question, Helena, when you're talking about second line therapy, how is it an influence? We talked about the three major options that we are looking at for first line therapy. How does the choice in the first line affect what you're going to do second line?
I've seen really crazy graphs now where, you know, everything that you do first line changes options second line, third line. It's like one of those, you know, squiggly maps where you can't go one place to the other. Yeah, I mean, I think it's going to be really individualized for a given patient. If you get ami laser in the first line setting, then you're probably going to get chemotherapy in the second line setting. If you got ami chemo, then maybe that would be someone that I would give, I mean, chemo osimertinib, maybe that would be someone that I would move to, you know, HER3-DXd in the second line setting. So I think it's going to be one of those things where for each patient, we'll have a specific set of options at each line of therapy.
So yeah, that's going to be really interesting to see how that plays out. Also the issue of toxicity. So Josh, you know, I hear DXd, and I think of obviously TDXd, which we have a lot of experience with. And a couple of things about that. I'm curious to what extent you think at this point it applies or doesn't apply to patritumab. One is the acute GI toxicity you see with TDXd. Do you see that same kind of thing with patritumab?
Yeah, so, you know, deruxtecan is a, you know, potent therapeutic. It's a topoisomerase inhibitor. It's a potent, you know, sort of payload. And we do see interesting toxicities. The GI toxicity we see, but, you know, more common to what I worry about is pneumonitis, right? So for the Enhertu, 10, maybe 15% at that 5.4 mgs per gig. Thankfully for Dato-DXd, a little bit lower. But again, these are not prior IO treated patients generally. So, you know, it's interesting that these are really potent therapies with broad toxicities, you know, more so than just the EGFR mediated toxicities that we've talked about so far this evening.
So, yeah, and the other thing I was going to ask about is, as it relates to patritumab, Helena, of course, is ILD. And it's really tricky now. Now that you have a pan-tumor approval, we have to talk to the GI people, the GU people, obviously the breast people. The breast people are, to me, the most aggressive about trying to look for ILD. What do we? You mentioned 5%, but, you know, I mean, 5%, could it be more than that? Could it be less? Any general feeling about how it's going to compare to TDXD in terms of threat and pneumonitis?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the threat is definitely less, but certainly more than what we've seen with non-deruxtecan backbone drugs. And I think what the challenging thing is diagnosing ILD with lung cancer, right? The patients are already having cough. They have shortness of breath. They have interstitial infiltrates from their lymphangitic disease. And so that, you know, the diagnostic dilemma of is this progression? Is this infection? Is this pneumonitis? Really is something that, you know, we're struggling with on a day-to-day basis.
So let's talk a little bit about Dato-DXd. We're talking about that, of course, all the time now, not just in lung cancer, but what do we know about this in terms of the Tropion study there, Lung-05?
Absolutely. So Dato is, again, a cousin of both patritumab and trastuzumab deruxtecan. It's datopotamab deruxtecan. It's a TROP2 ADC. Being looked at in a wide variety of settings in lung cancer, including just non-small cell lung cancer at large, Tropion Lung-05 was looking at patients with driver mutations, so patients with metastatic disease and had an actionable genomic alteration, which you can see abbreviated AGA. And so this looked at primarily EGFR mutations, but also ALK, RET, ROS1, and looked at after targeted therapy and after chemotherapy, was this agent active? I think the bottom line is we did see activity, tumor shrinkage in the majority of patients. When looking at the largest subgroup, which was the patients with activating sensitizing EGFR mutations, response rate looked good, 43.6%. And so this is, you know, smaller numbers, but median PFS of 5.8. So again, like, when should we use patritumab deruxtecan? When should we use datopotamab? That biomarker question keeps coming up in terms of figuring out what to do. I think similar to all the other ADCs, you know, we initially thought with these ADCs, they're bulky, they contain the antibody, and we're not going to get CNS penetration, but they all seem to penetrate the CNS, where, you know, we see intracranial activity with all of these drugs. And so that, again, was reiterated to not be an issue with datopotamab. And safety, similar. You know, the unique toxicities I would note for datopotamab deruxtecan were more mucositis with the TROP2 antibody. We're definitely seeing stomatitis, mucositis, and maybe some more ocular surface toxicity like keratitis. So those would be the two that are distinguished, you know, dato from patritumab or trastuzumab. And then again, we mentioned ILD as something that we see.
So yeah, just to pick up on what you're saying about brain mets and ADCs, we're seeing that, in, for example, breast cancer, TDXD for sure. I'm curious whether you've seen brain responses to Dato or to TDXD. Have you seen that, Helena?
I have. We have the datopotamab osimertinib study as part of the ORCHARD study, and I've enrolled a few people with brain metastases and have seen, you know, sort of parenchymal shrinkage and disappearing both with that and HER3-DXd.
So, Josh, any comments about the toxicity of Dato? I think Helena was mentioning the mucositis, which is a little bit new, I think, for lung cancer people in general. The breast cancer people say they can treat it with a, you know, switch and swallow steroids. What's your experience?
Yeah, so, you know, I've treated patients on the Tropion Lung-05 study, and, you know, stomatitis can become a real issue. You know, some of the things we have patients do is, you know, suck on, you know, ice popsicles to help mitigate that. But also really important is oral care, you know, swishing and swallowing, for example, or swishing and spitting, in the sense that making sure that we don't run into infections. You know, other toxicities that we see, we talked about the pneumonitis and we talked about some of the hematologic toxicities. But, you know, this is a drug where patients in general are not feeling that great overall. And when I exhaust all of my targeted therapies, EGFR targeted therapies, yeah, I think these are great therapeutic options. But when I have other EGFR targeted therapies available in the armamentarium, I much prefer to use those if possible.
So I'm really curious about this BDTX fourth generation EGFR. We're in four generations after 20 years. I also see the term master key, which I'm not sure where that comes from. But Helena, tell us about this interesting agent.
I think, yeah, we'll have to see how high we get with generations. But fourth generation EGFR TKIs, really as a class, and BDTX-1535 is included there, target the classical mutations, which are really L858R and exon 19. Many of them target what we call PACC mutations, which are primarily the exon 18 alterations or exon 20 or doublets like S768I. And then also target the acquired EGFR alteration, so the resistance mutations, and that most commonly is C797S, but also can include G718 or G724. And so those are the areas that the efficacy is kind of focused on for these fourth-gen TKIs. And exactly that, the classical driver mutations, the intrinsic driver mutations, which are kind of previously described as atypical alterations, and then the acquired EGFR alterations, all are hit by many of these fourth-gen TKIs. And we've really only seen early data for BDTX-1535, but in the patients that have longer follow-up for us to see efficacy, you can see that patients had partial responses with acquired C797S, with atypical mutations like the exon 19 L747P or L718Q. So I think intriguing. These are, you know, these are drugs where amivantamab, lazertinib, osimertinib don't have the label. And so finding drugs that are active for these atypical EGFR alterations really is an unmet need for sure. And then this just shows we use ctDNA clearance as a proxy of kind of disease responding, and that we saw ctDNA clearance on these agents. And then just to mention the fourth gen TKIs, you would hope that things would get more and more mutation specific. But when you target more EGFR alterations, you get more wild type EGFR toxicity as well. And so not just with BDTX, we're seeing more rash, diarrhea with some of these fourth gen EGFR TKIs as well.
So, Josh, any thoughts about this interesting agent and the fourth generation inhibitors and that whole concept?
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a really exciting time. We talked a lot about EGFR activating mutations, exon 19, DEL, and LA58R. We mentioned the very rare exon 20, but these PACC mutations, G719, 768, this probably makes up 10-15% of the EGFR mutations, and you know, might be 2-3% of non-small cell lung cancer. So very important space. We saw an update on a drug called furmonertinib at World Conference Lung Cancer just one day ago now. Exciting, 240 milligrams achieves a response rate of upwards of 60%. Again, like Helena mentioned, some of these fourth-gen EGFR inhibitors, instead of moving to be more specific and EGFR wild-type sparing, are actually more EGFR wild-type inhibiting. And, you know, we're seeing more diarrhea, for example, more rash with some of these agents. So I think it's important to think about how to target these hard, you know, to treat mutations, but also how do we better develop rationally designed therapies for this patient population?
Helen, anything you want to say about this paper? I guess it's just presented yesterday at the meeting. One of the MET, and these are people with de novo MET aberrations. Yes. Anything you want to say about this?
I mean, what I think is great about this, Neil, is like the idea of, you know, patient selection again. So I think, you know, we talked about higher risk and lower risk, but this is looking at, you know, a patient's cancer and saying there's something about it that shows MET activity. So why not do a MET inhibitor with osimertinib? So, you know, again, just other ways to personalize therapy for our first line patients. And Josh kind of nicely laid out the reasons why, you know, that many people don't get to second line therapy. We might be able to improve survival with better first line care. So, you know, I think just this ended up being a pretty small patient population, about 5% of patients with EGFR mutant lung cancer, but you know, the more we can, you know, personalize care, the better.
So, anything you want to say about some of these other new approaches that are being looked at in trials?
It's complicated, right? I think Josh mentioned, you know, I think, you know, you think that we would just say EGFR mutation, oh, there's one way to treat this. But now, like, you know, and this isn't just EGFR, but EGFR in particular, where you need to know, you know, what exon is it, you know, what, you know, is it acquired? Is it, you know, initially present? So I think, you know, phoning a friend or, you know, listening to these great podcasts and presentations like yours, Neil, really become key.
So Helena and Josh, thank you so much for this whirlwind EGFR tour. I feel like there's so much more we could be talking about, which is really an indication of how much is going on in the field. But speaking of targeted therapy, we'll be back tomorrow, 5 p.m. Eastern time, with Dr. Gogo Jack and Dr. Langer talking about other forms of targeted therapy. And there are many, as you know. And then, of course, on Thursday, we'll be talking about immune therapy and non-targeted therapy. Audience, thank you for attending. Come on back tomorrow night. Helena, Josh, thank you so much. Be safe, stay well, and have a great night. Thanks so much, Helena. Thanks, Josh.